Okay, let me see this picture.
There's two of them.
It's a Play-Doh, it's a big old Play-Doh thing.
Yeah, and then read the note on top for me.
Found with bloody tampon inside. It has been removed. There is dry blood on the inside of container. Not sure if blood got on all of the Play-Doh, but did get on some. Wasn't for sure how to handle the claims part. Oh my God. Did you write this or did you find
I found it whenever I went to
it?
take some busted bleach over to claims. It's like,
Someone
what
put a bloody tampon in a big old Play-Doh tub.
the fuck? They went over to the toy department specifically.
To put it in there.
Yes.
I was like, oh, it looks like a trash can, but no, not really. It's pretty clear. Oh my God. Okay. Well, you know.
It's my new photo to show to people we've just hired so that they understand what they're getting themselves into.
Yeah, bloody tampons everywhere. Jesus. It makes me wonder if it was like, because there's a variety of like bloody tampons, could be one of those dry ones you have to like really yank out. Could be like soaked through,
I just want to know the thought process. Like, I know the toy department is like 20 yards from the bathroom.
They couldn't make
You
it.
were right there.
Maybe they didn't know. They were like, where am I? Some people, I feel like when they're in public, they just lose the ability to like look at their surroundings.
Like, you know what? This Walmart must have zero bathrooms for all these customers and all these employees. I know what I have to do. I just don't know if I have the strength to do it.
Exactly. Yeah, and then just squatted and yanked it out. God,
Did nobody see them do it?
that's fucking gross, but thank you so much for sharing. I
You're
live for
welcome.
this type of shit.
You are welcome.
I don't have anything like that to share with you.
What have you been up to the last couple of weeks?
Oh God, nothing really. Yeah, that's true, really nothing. I've baked several pies.
Ooh.
Went to a wedding, going to another one this weekend. Like nothing interesting to say. It's like frightening.
I don't know enough people to go to weddings all the time. I've been to like two weddings in my life.
I went to a lot growing up because I had a lot of older cousins and they all got married like relatively young. I mean like early to mid 20s and had huge weddings, like 200 plus people. And so I was invited to those. I would say I've been to probably like 15 weddings.
That's so many. That's so many weddings.
It is a lot. And guess what? They're all the same.
Yeah, my
So,
sister goes to a lot of weddings too, and it's like, why do you know this many people? Like, I feel like we should know the same people.
right.
But you go to way more weddings than I do.
Well, it's interesting because I've recently started, only recently started going to the weddings of people who are not in my family.
Yeah.
Like friends have just started getting married, which is way more fun.
I went to a coworker's wedding. That's one of the weddings I went to. It was a gay
Nice.
wedding. And it took
Nice.
place on like Halloween. It was cool.
Ooh, that is
Spooky.
cool. No, mine are pretty much all the same, just a Catholic wedding. Some in a church,
You've
some
seen
not,
one, you've seen them all.
truly. And then like sort of a banquet style reception with like white people dance music. Yeah. And like a buffet. The wedding I went to in June was like it was good. It was a friend's wedding from high school, and I was sitting next to another friend from, well, actually this friend, I've known him since kindergarten, but it was his first white people wedding. He's Mexican, and so he would lean over and he'd be like, is this like standard, like they had a band, and he's like, is that do all white people do that? I'm like, oh, not really, you know, it depends. And he's like, this food that they're having, is this like typical like white people wedding food? And like the dessert table, he's like, is that a thing? I'm like, yeah, welcome to the wonderful world.
I was like, people his, weddings.
Right. I was like his tour guide. Yeah. So that was fun. But yeah, going to St. Louis this weekend for the other wedding, Chris's cousin's mm-hmm. wedding. It's going to be like over 300 people.
That's too many. I know, like three people.
I know. I think it's a lot of like the couple's parents inviting like all their friends and all the people they know too, which like I'd rather die.
It's weddings, they just baffle me. I used to, I thought about it whenever I was younger. I'm like, if I get married and like my sister did, my sisters are my bridesmaids. I'm like, who the fuck's going to attend the wedding? Like, that's mm-hmm. it. That's my that's guest all list. You know.
Yeah. Well, that's all I had at my wedding, just immediate family.
It's like, I got to pick one. It's either they're standing next to me and the pews are empty or vice versa.
Right. Yeah. I truly do not get it how people have like hundreds of guests.
Spend all that money for a bunch of strangers to watch so you much awkwardly confess your love to another person.
Nightmare situation. Truly. Yeah. The fact that I thought for any second that I wanted a big wedding is just silly. Because, like, yeah, absolutely not. I would have had a terrible time. I'm so glad it was just 20 people.
And the photos are cute, too.
Thanks. I really liked our photographer. She was like a hype woman.
Mm-hmm.
It was really nice. Cause yeah, it's like, what could be more scary than a whole day of someone taking photos of you?
Just following you around with a camera.
Yeah. But she made it seem like she was just our friend. So it was cool.
Good.
Yeah. Anyway. What a range we've covered already. Tampons, weddings, pies.
Moving through the circle of life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's like maiden, mother crone. Tampon, yep. Wedding, pie. Oh my god.
We did it again.
I'm there. Yay. Okay, I think we can stop now. Wait, should we keep doing the intro? I'm like so out of it. Okay, let's do the intro. Hello.
Hi.
I'm Sarah. I'm having an existential crisis.
I'm Liz, and that's as much as I know today.
Welcome to Saints and Witches, to our 70th episode.
Yeah, so much. Too much.
Yeah. Too many.
That's a lot of pennies. We're almost yep. at three quarters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. It's so scary.
I don't know how you got me to commit to something for this long, but kudos
the fact
to
that
you.
The fact that I am still doing it too is wild.
We have just are shackled together.
Yeah.
If I go down, you go down.
Yes, 100%. In a good way.
In a very good way. And let's try new things way.
Shackled together. Oh my god.
And like a really fun kind of like handcuffed together up to shenanigans kind of way.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Like on Survivor when they'd have to do the blindfold challenges.
Yeah. Like that.
So yeah, that's Saints and Witches. Today we're talking about maybe we don't have to get into it. What are we talking about? What are you talking about?
I'm talking about the Mongolian Empire.
Okay, me too, kind of a little bit. Mostly one dude on a death mission.
And I'm excited to hear it.
Cool. Let's get into it.
I wanted to do something different this episode. So I asked myself, what do I know absolutely nothing about? It's a very long list of things. Mm-hmm. But the first thing that popped into my head was the Mongolian Empire. I don't know why, but I was like, you are in fact right, brain. I know not a single thing about the Mongolian Empire.
Same. I knew nothing. Maybe horses? Question mark.
I could picture what they were dressed like and like the vague area that they were located.
Yeah.
I didn't know Mongolia was a country. I just knew Mongolian Empire. Liz. That was it. No, okay. I got my education in the middle of fucking nowhere.
I think that I learned recently that it was, which, by the way, whenever I say that, I'm talking about TikTok, just to make that abundantly clear. But I think it was like Mongolia is the least populated country in the world for how like big it is.
Big it is.
Yeah. It's fucking huge. It's gigantic. And there's like 3 people that live there.
It's like my home county.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't know why I didn't realize that Mongolia still existed. I think I had it mixed up with Mesopotamia in my head just a little bit.
A little different, but...
I know they're different things, but my brain still had them conflated.
They do have some of the same letters.
They're both old.
Yep. One much older than the other.
That's it. That's all in my brain needed. I looked up witchcraft in the Mongolian Empire just to see if there was anything at all, and the accounts that there were are like itty bitty, but I want to talk about the Mongols, and it's fine if the witchcraft portion is super tiny, because we're just gonna have fun today.
Yeah, we're gonna vibe.
Yes, I'm going to take the opportunity to talk about the Mongols and kind of follow their royal family line a bit into the like small group of women that I do want to talk about. So there are plenty of sources on the internet about the Mongolian Empire, obviously. Thank you to all of them, just a blanket thank you. But I want to especially thank See You in History on YouTube for giving me kind of the basics on the Mongols as a starter. I like to try and find a YouTube video if I can to give me like a, I'm going to talk to you like you're a fourth grader, but not in like a super dumb way. Just so I know what I'm getting myself into before like the Encyclopedia Britannica is throwing like regions and shit at me.
That's really smart, because I don't do that, and then I'm like floundering around with like 500 tabs open and like crying and having a mental breakdown and shitting my pants.
If I start getting like 3 or 4 paragraphs in and I can feel my brain doing like the TV static, I'm reading but I'm not paying attention right now, it's like,
yeah,
I gotta go have somebody introduce all of this shit to me. That's and smart. Sometimes I'll watch a bunch of those really tiny documentaries, even if they all say the same thing, because if I'm by the 3rd or 4th one and they're like, oh, and this person, I'll be like, oh, this guy who was born at this time in this place who had these kids, and it just like hammers it into my head.
I like how it's episode 70 and you're telling me how to do the podcast, because I still don't know.
I'm telling people my learning style.
Yeah. And I'm like finally maybe just figuring out mine.
Yeah, my learning style is I don't listen very well. And I need to be told like 50 times before I finally can go, oh yeah, that guy's related to so-and-so. And then I still have to double check just a little bit.
Right.
But thank you to See You in History for like the quick like 20-minute rundown on the Mongols. Thank you to Useful Charts for breaking down the family tree, because I got to see the visual. Also gave a little bit of background on everybody as it went and got to hear some of the more correct pronunciations of things as I went. So that was nice.
Yeah.
And then as always, a giant thank you to Kings and Generals on YouTube. They are fantastic. Something about their videos and my autism like really get along. Like I start to understand why my dad likes the History Channel when I watch Kings and Generals on YouTube.
Yeah.
Because it's just it has history as you go, but it's all about like military movements, and then it zooms into specific battles and shows you like this flank moved here and shot arrows and this was crushed and they crossed this river, and like it's just super visual and super cool. And I love it.
That is so dadcore.
It is, but it's just the fact that, like, they put so much effort into, like, these battle graphics and everything, mm-hmm. and all this shit is free. They're, like, hour-long videos that are just fucking free.
Nice. That is cool.
So I watched that one, like, second or third, just to kind of get an idea of, like, how everything started, how big it got, some of the major players, where everybody was. I'm not going to get into a whole lot of what that video went into, but it's very interesting. And I suggest watching it because I was glued to the screen for the entire hour that it played.
Wow.
As for sources on the Mongols themselves, the book Women in Mongol Iran by Nicola? I don't know. I found it at midnight last night. It's the book that I told you about that's like 300 pages long. And I was just like, let's see what other sources I can like scrounge up to like pad my like notes together before I write my story in the morning. And then just in the depths of like the internet, 7 pages deep, I found this entire like PDF of this book. Wow. It's like, I'm going to read this 300-page book. And then sure. I fell asleep reading it, and I remember nothing about what I read. I'm really sorry. This is a book that I knew was going to be super useful and interesting, but did not stick to my brain.
It's okay.
It does mention in the introduction, though, because I did force myself to go back and at least reread that, that pretty much every account we have of the Mongolian Empire is coming from conquered or in danger of being conquered peoples.
Mm-hmm.
We have sources from Persia and China. We have sources from Europe, which include diplomatic documents, anthropological accounts, and then accounts written by people like Marco Polo, who are interested in the commercial opportunities in Asia. Mm-hmm. Which greatly involved the Mongols because they came to own and protect a majority of the Silk Road.
Mm-hmm.
We have sources from Christians and Muslims, and whether they view the Mongols as an ally or an enemy in the war on their faith determines how the Mongols are depicted in their literature and their iconography. We also have a document called The Secret History of the Mongols, which, although by this point the Mongolian Empire had decreed that they would finally start like writing down their language in this set script, was not written down in that script. The document is instead phoneticized Mongolian transcribed into Chinese characters.
Jesus.
So like the most roundabout way we could possibly have the Mongols accounts of themselves, but it's like the only surviving document that we've got where it's like what they have to say about themselves. This come a little bit third party, but with that, let's learn about the humble beginnings of the Mongols.
Yes.
The Mongolian Empire starts with the, and fair warning, I'm going to butcher the pronunciation of most of this because I lost my pronunciation pardon. I'm so sorry.
Me too, but I didn't even try. So
it starts with the Kamag Mongol, a nomadic confederacy living in what becomes China. It's north of what becomes China and south of what becomes Russia.
Okay.
Like, none of this stuff actually exists at this point. It's just a bunch of loose groups of people.
Sure.
Confederacies and stuff right now.
Like we like to say.
Yes.
It's just a bunch of people hanging out.
It's just a salad over there right now of people, okay?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
just exactly. In the middle of it, in the vague area of China and Russia.
Right.
There are other nomadic groups in this area, like the Tartars and the Khitans, and these groups are in dispute for a mix of reasons. The first is that these groups are nomadic, so their camps are constantly shifting territory and they're bumping into one another. Another is that bride theft is an issue. The Mongols want to keep their group strong and others weak, so they are stealing women from other clans. And this is, I mean, something that is not exclusively practiced by them.
Right.
But stealing brides also happens because some men are too poor to pay bride price. You have to offer the father something in exchange for your wife. So if they want a wife, sometimes they just have to go dig one. I figured this out.
Oh my god. I almost said 5 second rule, and then I'm like, no, that's different. That's something else. Anyway.
That's if he drops her.
If he drops her, he has 5 seconds to pick her up. Yeah.
Yes.
Otherwise, he can't eat her.
Moving on.
Yes, please.
Yet another reason the groups fight is that I'm saying China, but you have to understand that China is a loose group of people doing mm-hmm. things.
Yeah.
To the south, they're deeply invested in making sure that these nomads never join forces and get it into their heads to like invade and conquer the area that the Chinese people are occupying. So they scheme and they pay different nomadic groups to attack each other, like, constantly.
Nice. That's smart.
I'll give you $50 to go kick that guy in the head. Make it 100 and you got a deal.
It's like, this is great because I really need a wife.
So that's pretty much what the Chinese are doing. They're like, it's like cut your kids in the other room. It's like, they'll keep themselves busy.
Or like us giving weapons of war to the Taliban. Same thing. Anyway.
Let's talk about that on the 4th of July.
I know. I was just like, oh yeah, by the
way, happy birthday, America.
We're recording this on America's birthday. America the beautiful.
America can get fucked after the Supreme Court decisions this week.
Supreme cunts.
Yes, they are. Anyway, the Mongols are an interesting group. They're nomadic because the herds that they keep demand new fields to graze, so they have to just follow them around all of the time. They also keep a lot of horses, which are shorter than the average horse you might immediately think of, I believe, but they're like sturdy and they're still really fast.
Mm.
Because so much of their life is composed of travel, both men and women need to know how to ride horses, and horses are an important part of Mongolian warfare. The Mongols master the art of steering their horses with their knees to keep both hands free for archery, which I thought was pretty cool.
It is fucking cool.
Look, Mom, no hands. Mm-hmm. And in fact, some Mongols spend so much time on their horses starting so young that later in life they actually develop joint problems.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah, your hips and your knees would be like mm-hmm. super fucked.
Yeah, even just riding a horse for like a half hour, I feel like my pelvic bones are gonna crumble into dust.
Yeah, so imagine like 15, 20 years of that.
Absolutely not. Not for me. God bless.
Hard pass. Mm-hmm. Wealth in Mongolian culture is measured by the number of animals a man keeps. So his herd, horses, camels, I think dogs too. Mongolian men can have multiple wives along with concubines, but there's always a senior wife and a junior wife if he has multiple wives. And they have to place their huts in like very specific configurations in the camp. So the doors of the huts have to face south. I'll talk about that in a second. But the senior wife has to be at the west of the camp, and the junior wife has to be at the east of the camp. I don't know where the concubines are. It just says with them following close behind. That's okay. Not a cardinal direction.
No.
The huts they live in are called yurts. I composed a picture of them, but it's pretty self-explanatory. It's like a tent. Mm-hmm.
Yurts are what they use now for glamping.
Yeah, exactly. It's something that we as white people have stolen.
Yes. Yes, yet another.
Hooray for us.
Mm-hmm.
It's the duty of wives to dismantle and pack these yurts when the camp moves, as well as to drive the cargo wagons. There isn't an overwhelming amount of mention of Mongolian women in the literature outside of like the wives or daughters of the royal line, because like they weren't really important other than when they were like belonging to important people.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have information about what their lives and duties would have looked like. I mentioned bride price earlier, the price a groom has to pay a bride's father. Women also come with dowries, which were inherited by the youngest of her sons. I don't know why the youngest. It's always the youngest among Mongolian culture.
That's interesting.
Which I find unique
It is.
Where possible, families would do double weddings, like my son and daughter will marry your daughter and son in an effort to like PEMDAS cancel out bride price and dowry.
I see. That's smart.
Yeah. I don't know you jack shit. Here's my kids.
Just trade them around.
Yeah. It's one thing for my parents to arrange my marriage, but if they did it just to get like a BOGO, I think I'd lose.
BOGO. No, that's good. That's terrible. I hate it. But I mean, it makes sense.
It does. I get it from a save money standpoint, but at the same time, like, come on, mom.
Yeah.
Women are just as capable as men in Mongolian society. They hunt, they ride, they tend to animals, they make cheese and butter, cook, take care of the kids. The men might be away for weeks at a time, so they have to be able to step up and take over their duties, but in the same way, they're expected to take over those responsibilities in the death of their husband. Women are allowed to drink. Women are allowed at major feasts. When men ride into battle, women drive the wagons loaded with the yurts and goods behind them. Women entertain warriors, visitors, and allies with speeches promoting their husbands and with good hospitality in an effort to strengthen loyalties. Women can ask for divorce or own property, theoretically. I don't know if there's any record of this having actually happened, but it says that it can. Property was inherited by the senior wife's youngest son.
Okay.
And this son usually stayed on living with his parents with his own wife for that reason, because like he's going to inherit the land and the properties anyway. He might as well just continue living there. Widows also represent their late husbands at tribal gatherings, which I think is cool. When it comes to religion, the Mongols are a little unique, I think. They do have some of their own beliefs. They believe in a sky god, Tengri, and an earth goddess, Etijin. But they don't have a written language, so they don't have sacred books. They kind of remind me of the Druids a little bit. They don't have their own like stuff written down, but other people write things about them.
Right.
They don't have an order of priests. They don't have services for the public to attend, like a mass or anything. They also, once they do start to conquer the continent, don't really care about religion at all. It's not about religion for them. There's a general attitude of, like, as long as you're using your gods to pray for the health of our great leader, whatever, you do you.
Right.
I forget how one person phrased it, but they said that the Mongols were pretty much just interested in as much like celestial insurance as they could get and weren't really picky about it.
Okay.
Which is why you see so much like conversion happening like within them. Like some of them will be Buddhist and some of them will be like Taoist and everything. Like it's not a huge deal.
That's so, like, very interesting. Get kicked
out of the family.
They're like, well, might as well try to get in good with everybody.
I think that is interesting.
It is.
Like, let's just try to make everybody happy so I can go to everybody's heaven.
Yeah, that's smart.
Their attitude with their own gods reminds me of how, like, the Nordic gods were worshipped, kind of in this, like, familiar, friendly, informal sort of dialogue between, like, man and god. You know, you don't need to be in a church and go through a proxy. You don't need to be on your knees and be supplicant. It can just be kind of like you talking casually to the gods. And maybe you take off your hat or maybe you stand on a hillside when you do it, but that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, that's kind of how I pray. I just sit in the car and it's like, well, if anybody's got their ears on right now, I am having a mighty shit day.
Testing. You have a microphone. You do like stand-up comedy. One, two, three. As prayer.
Check.
You're like, so where's everybody from?
The Mongols do have shamans, which can be men or women, but are like most often men. They wear white and sing and read the future from cracks and burnt sheep bones and conjure rain and bless people and go into trances and communicate with the spirit world. They find people and they find things and they perform exorcisms. I couldn't find any folklore or mythology attached to the Mongols, really. Just like a group of superstitions that are attached to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mentioned that the yurt doors need to face south. I don't know why south specifically. It was just very important that the doors always face that way. Believing the running water blocks evil, that you shouldn't step on the threshold of a yurt, like directly step on it. Don't spill royal blood. Don't put a knife near a fire. And importantly, don't bathe or piss in a river.
Oh, shit.
Water was sacred. Don't dirty it.
Think about all the times I've like peed in bodies of water. They would hate me.
You could get in a lot of trouble for doing any of those things. Mm-hmm. They would make people walk between fires. They would execute people. They would do it to like their own people, but they would also do it to, what's the word I'm looking for? Like a potential ally. Like, mm-hmm. if they ever did anything, like, one of these superstitions, they did something they weren't supposed to, they would make them, like, walk between fires to prove right. that, like, hey, it was an accident, and you're, like, actually here to abide by our rules.
Mm-hmm.
Not, like, you were deliberately giving us a middle finger by doing that.
Right. Yeah. My guy has to do that. Walk between the two fires.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Hey.
No. Yeah.
A connection already. A shaman named Kokchu, I don't know, got a little too influential, a little too powerful one time, and he was ordered to be killed by having his back broken to avoid spilling his blood, which might seep into the ground and lead to a haunting. But that is like the most horrific way I can think to die, because yeah. breaking your back doesn't kill you.
I know. I wonder how they did it.
Did they just keep doing it until he died of shock? Did they just put him out of his misery eventually?
Right. I mean, like, they used to press people over in Europe. Maybe it was like that. And yeah, you would just die from shock, I think, and kidney failure.
Yeah, you would have to. I don't know. Yeah. That's just horrible.
Yes.
It was different for me when I came across it. I'm like, I've definitely never in 70 episodes seen that as a method of execution.
That's horrible.
Snap a spine.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. On that note. I cannot really find anything on witchcraft per se, which feels like I've been lying this whole time about like what I'm doing here and what this episode's about.
That's okay.
Sources say, some sources will say like she was accused of being a witch or of witchcraft, or like he was accused of witchcraft, without like any explanation for like what they did or like what that means to the Mongols. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then another source about the same, like, people will turn right around and be like, oh, no, they were a poisoner, or they were just too into shamanism, or the Mongols met European influence and their ideas of witchcraft.
Right.
And that's why witch. And it's like, I don't know what it is.
It's frustrating.
The Mongolian Empire is so vast and covers so much time and space and mm-hmm. so many different religions and cultures and peoples that like I don't even want to attempt to tease apart the answer to like what is witchcraft to the Mongols, because I'm not even sure if there is a singular answer to that question.
Yeah,
we're discussing like a non-homogeneous continent of conquered people and their conquerors.
Yeah. Right. I'm sure it's like, if there is one, it's like all of the above.
Yeah, so I'm gonna leave the question of witchcraft at like that. Let some other scholar figure it out. Let somebody in some very specific section of the Mongolian Empire at some very specific time come up with an answer. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I get nothing. I can just tell you that all the sources say different things, and I don't know.
Yeah.
With all of that context on the Mongols as a people, I'm going to dive into the birth of the Mongolian Empire, which pretty much starts with a boy named Temujin. Temujin is born in 1162, most popularly. Like, there are like three different years, but that's the one that like Mongolia is like, yes, that one, for mm-hmm. no other reason than we took a vote. we like it the best.
1162 is like post First Crusade. Like, that's late.
It's later than you think it is.
Yeah.
Much later. And I was getting frustrated because every time they listed a date, they would say like 1162 CE. I'm like, okay, I know like in my brain that CE means like after Jesus, but I see the CE and I equate it to like BC, like immediately in my brain. It's like, why do we like need it?
BCE.
Yeah, it's just say it's 1162. My brain knows what that is.
My brain
knows what the year 1162 is.
Yeah, we live in that half of
the... We live in that era.
Right, not half. You know
we
what I mean.
We live in the common era.
This is when we find out I'm a creationist. Not what I meant.
Anyway, you get what I'm saying about seeing the letters and then I immediately think it's dinosaur times, but it's not. Yeah.
Yes.
Anyway, he's born in 1162, holding a blood clot in his fist, which apparently signifies that he has a great destiny to fulfill. And another account very sarcastically said, it's very easy to add these kind of details to stories about somebody's great destiny whenever you write, you know, this detail decades after they fulfilled their great destiny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've seen a little bit of that on the show, I would say.
Yeah, a lot of saints. Mm-hmm.
A sprinkling of that.
She had a dream.
Right.
Whenever she was pregnant.
It's right. Like, first word was, Holy Mary, Mother of God. Okay, sure.
Out of the mouths of babes.
Mm-hmm.
At 9 years old, Temujin's father, Yesuge, is poisoned by the Tartars. The rest of Yesuge's clan, members of a different family than him, decide to take this opportunity to usurp leadership of the clan because Temujin is nine. He's not old enough to take over. And there's, like, that's the order of succession. It's like, well, it's not that hard to beat a nine-year-old, so
it's really not. Anyone can do it, except maybe an eight-year-old. Two eight-year-olds could definitely do it, no problem.
They decide to take over and they tell Yesuge's widow, and this is me just making up pronunciations of names, I think I'm gonna go with like Holon and her children to get fucked and get out. Like, this is our clan now, be gone. Holun keeps herself and her kids alive through extreme poverty, and she's like patted on the back for that, and I feel like she deserves way more congratulations when she's like banished from her family with a bunch of young children
in the Mongolian desert.
Yeah, and it's cold and they're eating like plant roots and shit,
right?
And she keeps all the little brats alive.
Nice. So,
good for her. I'm proud of her. And this family does still maintain their royal blood despite like this abandonment, which is important because it's one of the reasons that Temujin can still retain the bride his father secured for him right before his poisoning. So his father like set this up and then he croaked. Temujin's like cashing in on that.
Yeah. Nice.
I'm trying not to drop like 500,000 names and clan names, so stop me if you get confused, but the rest of Yesuge's clan, the other rival family who kicked everybody out, they still have like major beef with Temujin, even though he's like been kicked out, because he is royal, one, and two, he is occasionally getting up to shit, like off on the Asian steppe. They capture him at one point and keep him prisoner at their camps in a wooden collar. Temujin escapes the first opportunity that he has, and though he's spotted, this guy is so impressed with Temujin's fighting spirit that he lets him go, which is kind of an early tale of how charismatic Temujin is and how people just cannot help but be pulled into the gravity of his influence. He's so dangerous.
Sexy. Another...
might take those words back.
I doubt it.
Another early tale, and again, trying not to drop a million names, involves Temujin's wife. So, Holun, Temujin's mom, Yesuge straight up stole her from the Merkit people. So, when Temujin claims his bride, a girl named Horta, the Merkit say, fuck you, your dad stole a woman from us. We are going to steal a woman from you. They kidnap Horta and likely sexually assault her while she has kidnapped. And unable to retrieve her on his own, Temujin uses the dress that was Borta's dowry. Don't quote me on this. I don't know why she was given a dress, but she has a really nice dress. And he's like, this is all that I possess in my poverty. And he uses it to bribe a chieftain to help him get Borta back. This chieftain, Togril, agrees and pulls in a childhood friend of Temujin's, Jamuka, and his army. So now there's like 20,000 of these guys all together that are going to go get Borta back.
Whoa, okay.
Just because he waved around a really nice dress and he has, you know, charisma.
I was like, he's like, pretty hey, nice. Look at this one.
What if I wear it?
This is a beautiful piece. Like, say yes to the dress. This is a Pinina Tournay. Sorry.
Very much. Okay, together they kick the Merkit people in the ass and save Borta, who 9 months later gives birth to Temujin's first son. But because of the kidnapping and the timing of the birth, the parentage of this son, Joshi, is unfortunately in question.
I know who you're talking about now.
Yeah, you should. Okay,
I'll keep it to myself, though.
Do you maybe want to take back your sexy comment?
No, not at all, actually.
Alrighty. Full steam ahead.
Big time.
Alright, over the next few years, Temujin, Togril, and Jamuka put different clans and nomadic groups in their places until it becomes, like, obvious that they are amassing a degree of power, and at some point one of them is going to have to, quote-unquote, be the guy in charge. The men themselves also see this turning point coming, and so they split ranks from one another. Some people rally around Temujin and others around Jamuka, and Togril throws his hat in with Jamuka. To dumb all of this down and sum it all up really, really fast, Temujin emerges as the victor and is renamed Genghis Khan, Genghis Khan, or Chinggis Khan, meaning roughly universal ruler. Khan is the title that means chieftain. It's a title that means chieftain, but it will take on the meaning of king as the Mongolian Empire forms. So like it because of Chinggis, the meaning of the word changes.
Got it.
Chinggis, which is one of the more popular pronunciations that I saw, it's like the closest to like its actual pronunciation and not like how us dumb Americans and Europeans say it.
Right. Yes.
Unifies the Mongol people, creates like a money system and laws and all kinds of shit, and then turns their eyes outward toward expansion on top of that. So it's like twofold. It's like, not only does he gather everybody up and it's like, hey, we're one people now, it's like, would you also like to have more than what we have?
Big time. He's making it happen. He's working overtime.
He is. I can't cover everything that the Mongols did or why they were interesting, which is why I'm recommending some of the sources that I used for the episodes, like the Kings in General stuff. Like, please watch that if you're even slightly interested in the Mongols.
If you're even slightly sexually attracted to Genghis Khan, <He's gone. laughs> I will be watching them this evening with a glass of wine. JK, 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 JK.
um it's endlessly fascinating to see how underneath essentially one ruler, the Mongol people went from nomadic, illiterate, and skilled really only in pillaging and warfare on horseback to becoming a unified nation with a written history that very, very quickly, through trial and error, taking prisoners and giving promotions to men of skill and not just men of royal blood, mastered warfare. They were so ridiculously good at siege warfare, even though to begin with they had no clue what they were doing. They were just nomads and could set up camp wherever for however long and kill whoever came out. And it's like, well, I've got some time to kill, so I'm just gonna like set up my fire here and my yurt, and I don't know, let's see what happens, I guess.
Right. Yeah.
And then they figured out steadily, they're like, oh, while we're out here, we can build catapults. Also, we can divert rivers. There's so much stuff that we can do. And they just got good at it real, real fast.
Yeah.
They were also famous for pretending to flee on the battlefield. They used this maneuver a lot. They figured out that if they ran away mid-fight and dropped a bunch of loot, that they could run the enemy ragged trying to chase them, then turn around as soon as their enemy got tired and just slaughter all of them. And they do this so often.
I know. And they always fall for it.
Every single time.
Oh my god. I was reading about this and I was like, this is fucking hilarious.
I know.
It's like watching the oldest trick in the book.
It's like, the second, third, fourth time, I'm like, surely at some point they're going to cotton on. No, every single time.
Yeah, and they get them. So funny.
It's hilarious. Let's see. They would also, in little, like, mini sieges, surround armies, but, like, whenever they, like, pinned an army back, like, against their wagons, inside, like, the circle of their wagons, they would just, like, accidentally leave a gap where the army could escape. Oh, no! Look at the gap we didn't cover that you can get through! Mm-hmm. And then as the army would escape, they would pick the men off just one by one.
Super easy. Just, like, so yes. Bored doing it.
Yes, not only because they could get them one-on-one like that, but because when they were fleeing, it was so much harder for people to also be in the offense as they were fleeing.
True, yeah.
Their backs are turned, they're just trying to get the fuck out of there, they're not paying attention.
It's they're like, freaking out.
Arrow to the noggin.
Mm-hmm.
Goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
They were famous for crossing things enemies deemed uncrossable and like wrote off as a possibility of happening at all. Mm-hmm. So they would send a flank of their men through an entire desert or over a river, like through the whole mountains, just to sneak up on people from the back, like as they were also attacking them from the front, and just fucking massacre them.
Yeah.
Because these people are like, no one can cross the desert. Like, only a dumbass would cross the desert, so we're just gonna fight them like this, and then be like, the Mongols are behind us!
Shocking.
They would do that every single time, too. Nobody would ever check behind them, but that's where the Mongols were always at.
It's so funny. Just them with their little ponies.
It's their little horses.
Yeah.
Let's see. They also made political maneuvers. There was one time specifically, I can't remember which group of people this was. I feel like it was the like Rus princes whenever they were attacking Poland, but don't quote me. Mm-hmm. But a bunch of like groups of people got together because they heard that the Mongols were coming, and they're like, we're not going to let you invade. We're so strong. You cannot get past us. And the Mongols just set up camp, and then they just sent like little envoys over there, and they just singled out one of the groups, and they're like, hey, we'll give you a whole bunch of money if you like ditch everybody else in the middle of the night and go home. And these guys are like, how much money are we talking? They're like, so much fucking money, man. And they're like, cool, deal, send the money. So they sent him a whole bunch of money, and then the night fell, and then they fucked off and ditched everybody else, and then the Mongols swept in, and they wiped out fucking everybody.
Oh my god.
And then they tracked down the people that they paid, and they fucking killed
them. Took the money back. I love it.
And they would do shit like that all the time. They're like, just let us through. We're not going to do anything. We just want to attack those guys over there. It's how I used to play, like, Risk. And be like, I'm your ally. I need to attack you so I can get to them. And then I would kill them. And it's like, dumbass, you're surrounded now.
I've never played the game Risk.
I was brutal in high school.
Shocking.
It was the first time I ever played the game, and they divided the class up into where like five or six of us were like one team, and there was like a president and like a general and all kinds of stuff. I was the president of my group. But I very quickly became like everything, because I just told everybody what to do. And I made so many deals, greased so many palms, and then slaughtered so many people.
Oh my god.
Yeah, we went from having a tiny little unassuming position on the board to I made no deals, no treaties, no one left alive. I raised the entire board.
Jesus Christ.
For like 3 weeks, I just killed everybody in my class.
Just systematic destruction.
Yeah, and they're like, peace, peace. And I'm like, no, I've got the bigger army.
You're like, I hate the word.
World domination.
Slaughter. Wow. I see it.
Yeah. I just had a really good time.
Yeah.
Good game, everyone.
Everyone's like, what the fuck? Psychopath.
See, I thought that I was a very normal child and I was masking so well. But then I look back as an almost 30-year-old at myself in high school, and it's like, yeah, there were signs.
Yes, there were definitely signs.
Anyway. In 1214, when Genghis Khan goes to take over Beijing, I don't know if it's actually Beijing at that point, everybody calls it Beijing, so I'm gonna call it Beijing, he fails when he tries to do this. The city is just impenetrable. The encounter ends in a stalemate where the Chinese pay Genghis, who cannot break into the city, to like leave them alone, because he's still surrounding the city and still kind of starving them out. But he can't get inside and actually burn it down, and it's been like years, been a very long time. So they pay him to go away, and he does, he leaves. But when he hears the Chinese are like moving everybody around, like as soon as he leaves the area, into in what sounds to him like a better position to fortify themselves, protect their royals, and maybe like plan for a counterattack. Because it's like, whoever was in Beijing, the second that they leave, they pull like all of those people out and go stash them somewhere else, and then start like setting things up. And it's like, it kind of seems like they're preparing for something. So Genghis is like, yeah, I know I just took all this money from you, but turn the wagons around. We're going back to Beijing.
Let's run it back.
Yeah. So he goes back to Beijing. And this isn't something that I wrote down, but one of the reasons that the Mongolian Empire was so successful is that Genghis is kind of massacring everybody, but he's not massacring people that are useful. So when he comes across like Chinese engineers and stuff like that, he's like, cool, you work for me now. Like, yeah. I'm not going to kill you. I'm going to give you a position of like authority within the Mongolian Empire. Give me your technology to then like commit even more heinous acts of warfare. And he does that with like everybody. Everyone he comes across, he's like, cool, I'm going to kill everybody except for the people who have talents that I can promote within the Mongolian army. And then he takes those skills, the carpentry, and all of this, and then goes and attacks more people with it.
Smart.
So when he goes back to Beijing, he has Chinese engineers now, and they develop him. I forget what they're called. They're like even bigger, deadlier catapults.
Trebuchets?
Starts with an M. I can't remember.
Something.
I don't know, but they bring those in and it just like literally demolishes the walls of Beijing. And like, this time, like the city falls and they like.
They have to do that to their own city.
Yeah.
Bummer.
It sucks. It sucks. Yeah. But it's the promoting people to positions of authority is one of the reasons that everything doesn't immediately fall apart. And it's also.
Yeah. And they don't just like attack and kill him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the Mongols aren't like defeating an area and then like going away. Like you see with like the Romans kind of, they would be like, well, I conquer this area and I put one man here and like you belong to us now, but we're going to go back to where we belong. The Mongols are like, well, we already got our shit packed in the wagon and it's out. It's right there. So we live here now.
We live here now.
we're buddies, we're friends, we're neighbors. Mm-hmm. And they just kind of did that everywhere. They adopted people into their army. They started living in these places. And it's like, well, we're all kind of quote unquote one peoples now.
Right.
But yeah, he conquers Beijing. And during his lifetime, the Mongolian Empire stretches its shadow almost from like coast to coast in Asia. It's kind of hard to pin down exactly where they're at. I know that they're obviously in parts of what will be China. A lot of the stands, like Afghanistan, Uzbekistan.
I was like, yeah, well, what?
You know all of those.
The stands, yep, I do.
The stands, the apostrophe stands.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no offense.
No.
This is me as a dumb American just saying I don't know the names of all.
No, yeah. I think they know that by now. They think we're just dumb.
But please think I'm dumb. I think Mongolia and Mesopotamia are the same thing.
Right. We covered that. Yeah. So.
Yes. Chinggis finally dies in 1227. I wrote that he died as a result of falling from his horse. I feel like I watched that in a documentary and then I never read it anywhere else. So perhaps that. But it's during a campaign against Jijia, which is how I'm going to pronounce it. It's one of the first peoples that the Mongolian empire attacked, and so it was kind of fitting that it was the last people that Chinggis attacked before he died.
Yeah.
The empire's undoing starts pretty much the very second that Chinggis dies, and power is divvied up between the bloodlines of Chinggis's sons, Yoshi, Ogade, Chagatai, and Tolui. And I'm sorry about all of those names. Ogade or Ogadai, son numero tres, succeeds his father as Great Khan of the Mongol Empire. I know that I think Yoshi is dead. The oldest son is dead because he died just before Chinggis did. I don't know why it doesn't go to the second oldest son. It goes to Ogade instead. Mm-hmm. He doesn't do a bad job. He creates the capital of Karakorum and implements taxation that builds on the money system that his dad fashioned. He is, unfortunately, a drunk. When he puts someone in charge of limiting how many goblets of alcohol he can have a day, just to, like, ease everybody's minds about how much of a drunk he is, he also turns around and just gets a bigger goblet.
He's so me. That's me imposing limits on myself.
Yeah, so he's generally regarded as like a decent ruler, but I do know without having read a whole lot about him that he makes decisions at like the end of his life about who he wants to succeed him, and people are like, yeah, nah, we think that your mind is, your brain is kind of eaten through by alcohol at this point, so we didn't hear you.
Right. Oh my god, that's so funny. They're like, that's so sweet. Actually, we're gonna do our own thing, but thanks so much.
We really appreciate your input. Mm-hmm. I think it was really nice. But yeah. No. He dies in 1241. I mentioned all of this to get firstly to Ogide's wife and widow, Torijin, who rules as regent after her husband's death, as she openly campaigns and greases palms to get their son, Guyuk, maybe elected as the next great Khan.
Mm-hmm.
Torijin isn't written about favorably. I mean, she's a woman in power, so obvi.
Yeah.
She's smart but shrewd, and she privatizes taxes, which hurts farmers. Where witchcraft crops up in her story is with a Muslim woman named Fatima, who is a former Persian slave that Torijin gives senior office position in kind of her court, which I thought was really interesting.
It is.
People who already don't like Torijin don't like her pushing her son's candidacy, don't like the idea of her son being the one to lead the Mongols. None of it. They say that Torijin is too influenced by her, like, Muslim council, especially Fatima.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is done until Guyuk is elected Great Khan. You know, even though he had, like, his mommy's help, like, the whole way there. He takes his brother Khodan's side when Khodan accuses Fatima of using witchcraft to make him sick.
Mm-hmm.
And Guyuk demands his mom hand Fatima over, but Torijin says, if you kill her, I'll commit suicide.
Whoa, they were in love.
See, that was my first thought. The text is like, it was just to spite her son. I'm like, no. She gave a slave a senior office position and said she's going to kill herself if she died.
They were fucking.
They were in love, Your Honor.
I want to watch this movie, Your Honor.
Yes, please.
We'll have to write it.
Another fan fiction.
We got a lot going on, but we'll get to it.
Eventually. Anyway, Guyuk seizes Fatima anyway and has his men torture her, sew up, quote, every orifice in her body.
Ouch. Quote,
and throw her in the river to stop her evil because of the whole, like, water is pure, purifies.
Sure. People,
good. Don't pee in it. Don't bathe in it.
Don't pee in it, but throw corpses in it all you want.
Yeah, it's just okay. so powerful and good for stopping evil that don't urinate in the river, but toss your corpses in there.
Please, by all means.
it makes perfect sense if you think about it.
I mean, it kind of does. Like, don't, like, make fun of the river, but, like, use the river for important things. That does make sense.
The river is super powerful and super good, so be nice to it. And it will gobble up your corpses for you.
Okay, I think I'm following.
Over the next months, Torijin's supporters are purged from the court and Torijin dies. Doesn't say how she dies. One source says that she must have been happy because her son was finally elected. And then it's like, she just threatened to kill herself because her son, like, tried to kill Fatima. So I don't know if she was super duper happy when she died.
I wouldn't say she was, like, super well adjusted.
No. Some sources say, like, oh, you know, it's kind of weird that we don't have any record of exactly how she died. She just dies a couple months after this whole debacle. It's like, yeah, I don't know what happened to her, but I definitely don't think that she was super happy.
Living it up.
In 1248, Guyuk is poisoned. Good for him. And his wife, I'm going to say Ogul, is left vulnerable. She's reigning as regent as members of the family are pushing for Monke, the son of Chinggis's son, Tolui,
which is
kind of hard to picture, to be made Great Khan. And they kind of install Monke as leader without, like, everyone's agreement. Like, they make their own, like, meeting, and they're like, well, we all decided he's in charge now. It's like, I don't think that really counts. Like, well, it was official. That was an official meeting. You just weren't there.
Officially, you weren't there.
It's too bad. It's really too bad. So sad. Mm-hmm. You lose.
Yeah. This is you playing Risk.
Yes. Ogle's grandson, angry, goes to pay tribute to Monkey, but really he just brings his whole army. It's like, I'm not really happy with what you just did, because technically my grandma is in charge. Monkey conspires with some people, and this is me not getting into a whole bunch of specifics and bringing in a million side characters, to then accuse Ogle of black magic to get rid of her.
Okay.
Like, well, if she's gone, then like we don't have this succession problem anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So Ogle is tried publicly by Monkey and Sorgatani. Sorgatani, Monkey's mother, and found guilty of either witchcraft or black magic or too much interest in shamanism, but also of treason, because whatever it was being used to, like, harm Monkey.
Okay.
She is stripped of her clothes, has her hands stitched together with leather, and she is tied into a felt sack and thrown into, again, the river to stop her evil.
Oh my gosh.
These women could not win as the men were fighting for succession of the Mongol Empire. And I feel so bad for them.
They're like weirdly caught in the crossfire.
They are. It's like, could you have your dick swinging contest somewhere else?
Somewhere else. Like, stop. Like, it's just hitting them.
God.
Get out of here.
The Mongol Empire will, not long after this, fracture into four khanates, which are like states, and fall into civil war as the sons, grandsons, cousins continue to fight amongst one another of who is the great khan. It will see success and ruin both under Kublai Khan, who is like two more steps down the line from where we're at currently. But for now, this is the story of the Mongolian Empire and just a few of the women that it tried and executed as witches.
Nice. Good job. I learned a lot. I filled in a lot of the gaps that I had after doing my research that I didn't have time or energy to look up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to talk about Guyuk in my story as well.
Cool.
Only a little, though.
Stupid fuckers,
I don't know either. And in my source, it was spelled with two C's. Kuyuk. I've seen it with
different in every single one. That was the hardest part about this research, is there are some sources I would just get into and they would start saying like the Chinggisid family. And I'm like, who the fuck are we talking about right now? What does Chinggisid mean? And they would just start using like everybody's names with like an ID on the end. It's just a way of denoting like all of the bloodlines, but in like the original pronunciations. So it's like, I don't know what the fuck's happening.
No.
I'm so lost. Who is this? Yeah. Who is it, a new person? Is it an old person? I don't know.
Well, you did a good job, regardless.
I want to learn more now.
Okay, let's do it. Okay, so my story today is basically just a book report. I have one source.
I love book reports.
I do too.
Takes me back to fourth grade.
I know.
Where's your poster board?
I know, I should have made one. It would be kind of lame, though, because this book is not very visual.
It's the best poster board.
I know.
All the letters are, like, half fallen off. You use, like, the purple glue stick so it leaves a stain.
Yeah, you see, like, fingerprints of purple glue stick everywhere.
You could see where you wrote something and then it didn't really erase.
There's, just, like, dog hair stuck to it. That was always mine, because I would do it on the living room floor.
It's torn.
Just like, yes, so bad. Because I got the cheap kind. Yes. Yeah. All the glue is like The pictures are all like warped from like using too much glue. All printed on like the shitty black and white laser jet.
Yes.
Really painting a picture.
I'm there.
Yeah.
You didn't have to make it. I see it.
I am just going to retell a translated 13th century primary source. I'm doing this because Mongolia doesn't have any saints. The church there is super small. I think I read there are like less than 1,500 Catholics in the entire country. And just like a handful of churches. Catholicism was first introduced in the 13th century when it was the Mongol Empire, and then it died out very quickly. They were not big fans of it. And a little bit of it came back, but only a tiny bit, and only very recently, like 19th century. So I am going to talk today about the journey of a Franciscan friar named Giovanni da Pian del Carpine, or Carpini. His name is anglicized as John of Plano Carpini. I think I'm just going to call him Carpini because I like how it sounds. And he's kind of like a silly like, little dude.
Like Weenie.
Exactly. Carpini the Weenie. And I stand by that, knowing a little bit about the man. He was a contemporary and companion slash disciple of St. Francis of Assisi. And he was an explorer who wrote the first significant Western account of Northern and Central Asia, Kievan Rus, and other areas of the Mongol Empire. Maybe some of what you read actually came from this book.
Neat.
Yeah. I really only have one source, like I said, which is his Historia Mongolorum, also called The History of the Mongols, whom we call the Tartars. I read Eric Hildinger's translation of the full text of that book, but parts of the book are excerpted in lots of different places. The book itself is a combination of historiography, travel account, and like spy mission report, like reconnaissance.
There were a lot of spies. I was surprised how many spies just like casually showed up in these stories.
Yeah, he's a spy. He's a spy of the Pope. The book was written for Pope Innocent IV, who sent Carpini on the expedition. The book has
sounded familiar.
Yeah, you probably came across him in your research. The book has 9 chapters, the 9th and final chapter being the actual story of his journey, so it's kind of like weirdly organized. The previous 8 chapters are the history of the Mongols as they told it to him, or as he heard it from others on his journey, interspersed with ethnography and some good old spy intel. Yeah, so the first chapter is about the geography of the land, the climate. The second chapter is about the people themselves, their clothing, their tents, possessions, marriage customs, a lot of what you mentioned already. The third and fourth chapters are about their religion, or lack thereof, kind of, their funeral rites, their food. The fifth chapter is the history of the empire, and the 6th, 7th, and 8th are all about how they fight in battle. Who they've fought and who they've conquered in the past, and how Europe should prepare in case of an invasion by the Mongols. So I'm basically going to focus on the 9th chapter, the travel story, and I'll intersperse information from the previous chapters as I go. So, yes, let's zoom out. And I'll tell you why Carpini was sent on this mission and like what led up to it before we talk about like who he was and get to the actual story.
And a brief note. I did a Google search in my stuff for Carpini. And when I said anthropological accounts, that was about him. So
yeah. He does his best. I think that his account, I mean, we don't know how accurate a lot of it is, because it's like he did try. I really think he did try, and for what it is, like an account of a people that like he would have considered barbaric based on his like background, I think it's remarkably objective.
He did a pretty decent job of even trying, like you mentioned, like food, funeral, like all of that stuff, just parsing all of that out.
Right. And not being like, oh, these disgusting fucking idiot losers, you know, like
those weirdos who like have sheep and camels and stuff and don't speak my language. They're just doing stuff.
Right. Yeah. He was a bit more objective than that. He, not like some of our other saints, like we've seen in the past going on their missions. Yeah. He was a little bit like, yeah, they drink horse milk. And we don't care for it, but they seem to really like it. It's disgusting.
It's an acquired taste.
Yes, exactly. Acquired taste. So the short version is that of why he was sent on this mission is that this was the period of the Mongol invasion of Eastern Europe. And Pope Innocent was sending him as a papal legate to the empire in order to offer peace to them. Potentially baptism, if that was something they'd be interested in. Maybe feel it out. Funny.
I hear you guys are burning and setting a lot of setting people on fire, just doing a lot of murdering. Could I offer you a nice dip in the river,
just to cool off? And
could I interest you in a conversion?
Right, and they're like, sweetie. Yeah, it's not successful. Just spoiler alert. And he is supposed to essentially spy on them. So the longer version begins with the Battle of Legnitz or Legnica, I think.
Yes.
Yes. Is this the one you're talking about?
No, I just recognized that from the Kings in General thing.
Got it.
It's one of the ones, one of the names that stuck in my head.
Well, it's like, yeah, it's stuck in my head too, because it's very particular. So Legnitz is German, Legnica is Polish.
Yes.
Yes. This battle took place in April 1241 near the city of Legnitz, which at the time was in the Duchy of Silesia. Leading up to the battle, the Mongols had attempted to subjugate a nomadic Turkic people called the Kumans. Again, just a guess at the pronunciation, and it's spelled like five different ways. I've seen Komani with like a C or a K. I'm probably going to use all the Western versions of the names because that was what was in the source that I read. But anyway, the Kumans fled westward from the Mongols into the kingdom of Hungary, where they were granted asylum by King Bela IV. When Bela refused to surrender the Kumans to Batu Khan of the Mongols, Batu invaded Eastern Europe. as you mentioned, you said a lot of this already, which I'm grateful for because I'm tired. But I'm trying to like figure out what I still need to say.
No, say it all again.
Well, I was just going to say that the Mongols were very fearsome warriors and intelligent strategists. And they used a diversion, like you mentioned. They invaded Hungary with two armies. Meanwhile, a third army invaded Poland as a diversion. Northern Poland and southern Lithuania were completely devastated. Krakow was burnt to a crisp. And finally, the Mongols met the combined forces of Poles and Moravians under the command of Duke Henry II of Silesia on the battlefield southeast of Legnitz on April 9th. The European soldiers were largely untrained and poorly equipped. I read that it was a lot of farmers with pitchforks, a lot of miners with pickaxes. Just some dudes, some dads, some brothers, some uncles.
I asked my mom if I had to be here, and she said no.
My mom said, as long as I come home before dark, it's okay.
I can only be here if I have a ride.
Can your mom give you a ride home? Exactly. Some sources mentioned that there were some Knights Templar there, or maybe Teutonic Knights. If there were, it was a very small amount, probably like 50 guys, maybe. Anyway, they were like, these soldiers were like militia, basically, like scrounged up at a moment's notice. And they were no match for the Mongols, who were expert horsemen and very skilled with bows. The Mongols communicated during battle by different colored flags or standards instead of like horns or like, more obvious signals. They also were, they, you said all this.
Say it again. I didn't know the flag thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the flag thing is super cool because it's like, you don't know what the, you don't know what this means.
It's like an umpire's secret signs.
Right, exactly. So they would do, often do, like you said, like a fake retreat. They would pretend they were retreating, and then when the Europeans followed them, they would use the landscape and their horses to divide the European army into channels, ambush them, and just fucking slaughter them. We don't know for sure how many Europeans died during the Battle of Liegnitz, but the Mongols had this custom of counting the men they killed by cutting off one ear from each corpse. And it's said that they filled 9 sackfuls with ears. So
it's a lot of ears.
A lot of ears, big time. Duke Henry of Silesia was killed in this battle while attempting to flee. He was beheaded and his head was paraded around on a spike.
Ooh, I do remember that detail.
Yeah, not great. In the aftermath of that battle, the Mongols were eventually driven from Eastern Europe by the Bohemian army, but this invasion had really shaken all of Europe. Like the idea that at such short notice something like that could happen, especially at a time when all the European countries were like always fighting with each other. To have like someone else be like, hey, also we're here and we can kill all of you whenever we want.
Yeah, and it's just a bunch of dudes on horseback and they're like, we're civilized society. That shouldn't be able to happen. They're like, aha, we'll set you on fire.
We will literally kill you. We will dig up the river so that it drowns you in your bed. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's
we're
fucking
not
scary.
Stupid. We're no. Just vicious.
No. Yeah, really bad, really scary. And the Europeans were like, yeah, and that I couldn't even get any reinforcements because I'm mad at my brother, who's the king of whatever, you know?
Yeah, just a bunch of petty shit.
Yes, exactly. So bad time for this to be happening. So we don't know that much about Carpini before his expedition to the Mongol Empire. We do know that he was, like I said, a companion of St. Francis. Based on his surname, he was most likely from the region of Umbria in Italy. We also know that he was pretty high up in the Franciscan order. Throughout his career before the expedition, he had held the offices of Warden of Saxony and Provincial of Germany. Kind of a big deal. He may have also held other positions besides these, including one in Spain, but that's not certain. So he was provincial of Germany at the time of the Battle of Liegnitz, and the fear of the Mongols was still very real and widespread 4 years after the battle, which was when Pope Innocent IV decided to send him as a legate to the Mongol Empire.
Sacrificial lamb.
Exactly. Literally. That's the thing, is nobody is expecting him to come back.
They're just hyping him up. They'll go fine. It'll be great.
Mm-hmm. It'll be so good. You'll love it.
You're not so much. Take so many pictures. I cannot wait to see your pictures.
He packs him his disposable camera with his like PB&J. He's going on a field trip. Now I'm just thinking of Toy Story 2 when Mrs. Potato Head is sending Mr. Potato Head off
with all this extra
stuff. Yeah, I'm like, I'm packing you an extra pair of shoes and your angry eyes just in case. I always loved that. And then he gets to put them on, yes. Like during a fight. I'm like, yes,
satisfying.
The angry eyes. Yeah, so he sent him with a letter. He pinned a letter to his coat to the great Khan or Kagan Emperor, which at the time of his departure was Ogedei, the third son of Chinggis Khan. This letter from the Pope was an appeal to the Khan to please, please, pretty please, stop attacking Christians. It was also an inquiry as to their future intentions. Like, hey, remember when you attacked us before? Are you going to do that again? And when might that be happening? And if so, it would be super cool. It'd be super cool if you, like, actually didn't. Love you. Bye. So it also was like, hey, this guy can baptize you if you want.
You have no idea what that means, but he's really good at,
but he'll explain it,
getting your hair wet.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he'll dunk you big time. So Carpini set out from Lyon, which is where the Pope was living at the time, with the letter and one companion, another Franciscan friar named Stephen of Bohemia, on Easter Sunday, April 16th, 1245. The friars went first to the court of King Wenceslas of Bohemia, whom Carpini was apparently old friends with. I don't know how they knew each other, but he's friends with the king. It was here that Carpini gained another companion, Franciscan friar Benedict Polak, or Benedict the Pole, who was to be their interpreter because he had studied the old Slavic languages. He's not helpful at all, but he goes. they're like, oh, yeah, you can come. He's like, I don't know this one. Someone else talks. He's, I don't know that one either.
That's not what I have my PhD in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mine was actually more Baltic. Like, sorry to bring it up. Yeah, together the three stooges made their way to Kyiv with letters of safe passage from King Wenceslas. At Kyiv, Stephen of Bohemia was left behind. This was not mentioned in Carpini's story, and Wikipedia just said that he broke down. I'm assuming. I was like... Like, mentally, or? I'm assuming it means, like, his horse or his cart or...
His broken down.
Stephen is no longer with us. He's not in a good place.
He has to be committed. He's really... on a 72-hour hold.
He was really bringing down the vibe, so we had to leave it behind. Well, I mean, okay, it would make sense if it was mental. I don't think it was, but it would make sense because Kyiv, where they're walking through, was recently kind of, like, destroyed by the Mongols. And so he describes, like, skulls and bones being, like, littered everywhere. Like, they're walking over human skulls and human bones constantly. And Stephen is like, for that reason, I'm out.
Yeah, I'm done.
Yeah. So anyway, Carpini and Benedict reached the Mongol outpost of Khaniv, where, and this is kind of like the frontier, where they met their first Mongols, who would journey with them to the camp of Batu Khan on the Volga River. So it was almost like they were stationed there. Like, a group of Mongols was stationed at the outpost on the frontier, basically. And then they sent some guys to accompany them, to supervise them, basically, and make sure they weren't just, like, fucking around. I don't know. But it was good for them because they might have died otherwise. They probably would have died otherwise. This leg of the journey from Kyiv to the Volga was about 1,200 kilometers, not a chill distance. They rode Mongol horses from camp to camp, and I thought this was interesting and made a lot of sense and was cool. This was like a Mongol thing to do, like a custom. When they got to a new camp, they would ditch their old horses and get new ones. So the horses were never like exhausted or fatigued or anything. I just thought it was cool that they had like enough to go around. Like there must have been an insane amount of these horses.
A community bike program. But
exactly. Horses. It's a yeah, it's a city bike. Yeah, I loved it. Carpini says the land they rode through was partly mountainous and partly plains, and the soil was a mixture of gravel and sand. There were some forests in the land, but not many at all. The land was not fruitful in the least and could not support any crops. There were no villages or cities because the people lived in movable tents with their flocks, like you mentioned. The weather was extremely variable with, you know, crazy snow and hailstorms in the summer and lightning that killed many people. Just like, boom, lightning, 100 men are dead. What the fuck? He also mentions this crazy hailstorm once when they were like camped somewhere that like it hailed for like an hour and like 160 people drowned in their tents. When the hail melted. Yeah, because it was like in the desert, like the water doesn't know where to go. So like when it does rain, it's like flash flood. It's like basically the scariest place on planet Earth.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons that the Mongols had a sky god, is because the weather was so fucking terrifying. Because
they were like, please.
They're like, there's no way anything about this is human. No fucking way.
That makes total sense.
They saw the lightning one time. They're like, there's a big dude up there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
definitely.
Right. It's not just random chance. Like, he hates us. Yeah. And sometimes the wind was so strong that the only thing they could do to protect themselves was just like throw themselves flat on the ground and just like wait for it to blow over, literally.
Hit the deck.
Yes, they had to hit the deck a lot. I bet they got a lot of sand and gravel in their mouths.
That's gross.
Yes. So let me get this thing out of my face. Sorry. Eventually they come to the camp or horde of Batu Khan. This was the same guy who had commanded Mongolian forces at the Battle of Liegnitz. He was the supreme Mongolian commander at the time and a senior prince in the house, and had been a senior prince of the house of Genghis Khan. And I liked this part, so I wanted to read an excerpt. Side note, Carpini refers to the Mongols as the Tartars or Tatars. This is obviously incorrect. They were distinct groups of people. The Mongols had actually defeated the Tatars in battle decades before this, and Tartars is probably a corruption of Tatars, because Tartarus is Latin for hell.
Yeah.
So, but the Mongols were known in Europe as the Tartars at this time, so he's using like the common terminology in his book. So he says, quote, when we came to Batu, we were stationed a good league from his camp. When we were taken to his court, we were told that we must walk between two fires, callback, which we did not wish to do at all. He was like, fuck this, that's scary. But the Tartars said to us, you will be safe. We only make you pass between two fires so that if you plan any evil for our lord, or if you bring any poison, the fire will carry it away. We replied, because we do not wish to be mistrusted for it, we will do so. When we had come to the horde, we were asked by an officer of Batu named El-Gadai what we wished to bow with, that is, what presents we wish to offer. Side note, this is kind of like a recurring motif in the story. Whenever they meet a new commander or Khan or general or really whoever of any importance, he's expected to produce some kind of gift for the guy. and he doesn't really have anything. So he's like scraping the bottom of the barrel, which is like unlucky because he doesn't meet the emperor until like months and months later. So he's having to give up a lot of the stuff that he brought.
Yeah. Hospitality is so important to them, which is one of the reasons that they end up massacring like half of the continent, is they're like, we're gonna send a bunch of people over to talk to you, and then they got killed and they're like, well, now we have to raise you to the ground.
Well, we tried.
You brought it upon yourself,
right? So he often doesn't have any gifts to provide. It's always like an awkward moment. But because this was the first time they were meeting anyone of importance, they did have a few pelts that I believe King Wenceslas had given them, because he's like, oh, you're going to the Mongols, you're going to need some presents. Let me give you some. We got fox, we got beaver. Like, he gave them a good selection.
They thought it was for themselves. They'd make it out like kings, and then they meet the Mongols, and it's like, oh, we are going to be in rags by the end of this.
Yeah, exactly. He continues, quote, after the gifts had been given and accepted, we were instructed to bow three times with the left knee before the door of the tent, and to be quite certain not to step on the threshold of the doorway, which we were careful not to do, because the penalty is death for those who knowingly tread on the threshold of any leader. I picture him taking the longest step over.
Or checking and seeing if no one's around and putting a toe on it.
Right. They're like,
It's like stepping on a crack to see if it breaks your mom's back or not.
Exactly. Just fully stomping. No, I never did that. I never did that.
No.
quote, so as we entered, we knelt and said our peace, unquote. After a lot of struggle, the letter from the Pope is translated. It has to go through, like, I think three different translations based on, like, who's there. Because, like, oh, this person understands such and such but can't speak it. This person knows, you know, Mongolian, but he doesn't understand Chinese. So it goes through, like, it starts in Latin, goes to Hungarian, like, it's crazy. So who knows, like, what the Khan even thought heard. That it said.
He wants to drown me in a river.
Exactly. Oh my gosh. So he finally gets the letter to read. Carpini says he read the letter and considered it carefully, and then he and Benedict were taken back to their camp and given a very small meal of millet for the night. Carpini is often complaining of hunger and thirst throughout his journey. He's said to be a bit overweight, but also he says the Mongols really don't feed outsiders much, whether these outsiders are ambassadors like them or slaves that they've taken from conquered nations. They're kind of given the bare minimum to eat a lot of the time, unless it's like for a specific show of honor, like we'll see later. Mostly because the Mongols have very little to eat themselves. There's like this long passage where Carpini talks about their good qualities. He's like, oh, these are all the good things that we like about them, in which he says that they treat each other really well. There are hardly ever arguments or injuries or murders among them. There's really no theft between them, like day-to-day wise. They help each other with their livestock and they share food very generously among themselves. But for outsiders, not so much. You're on your own. He says that the Mongols mostly eat meat, whether that's horse, dog, whatever they can get. He does mention occasional cannibalism, but he doesn't say that he witnessed it, so grain of salt there. And they drink mare's milk when it's available, and when there's neither meat nor milk, they eat millet mixed with water. He says even when they're starving, they don't act like it because they're used to it. So they're still, you know, going out, fighting people, joking around, having a good time, even if they're very hungry. Soon after arriving at Batu's camp, Carpini and Benedict are told that they must continue traveling and go all the way to the horde of the Emperor or Supreme Khan or Great Khan, Kuyuk, in the capital city of Karakorum. Kuyu Khan, like you mentioned, was the eldest son of Ogedei Khan, who had just recently died. So this was actually an interregnum period that they arrived in. But Kuyuk, as the oldest, was designated to become the new emperor, and they actually arrived in Karakorum in time to witness his formal enthronement. This was not a chill journey from the Volga to Karakorum. They traveled about 3,000 miles in a little over 100 days. Carpini writes that they were so ill by the end of it that they could barely sit up on their horses. He says they had to be tightly bandaged all over their body to help with the fatigue that came from being jostled so much by the horses. Just I imagine Squidward in the full body cast and jellyfishing. They show up like that.
With the worst grasp it.
The terrible gifts. The Khan's actually I'm gonna throw them in the river myself. He says that for the entirety of the journey their only food was millet with salt water and melted snow to drink. They finally reached the imperial camp on July 22nd and basically waited around with all the other common people while the election and the coronation were going on inside this huge yurt that Carpini estimated could hold over 2,000 people. I feel like that's me making an estimate. I don't do the numbers, so I'm maybe 2,000.
How many is 2,000?
Right. No idea.
No, that sounds right.
He says, quote, "Everyone else was outside, and they waited there until almost noon, and then began to drink mare's milk, and they drank it until evening, which was amazing to see. They called us inside and gave us ale because we did not like mare's milk in the least. And so they did us a great honor. But still, they compelled us to drink so much that we could not stay at all sober. So we complained that this bothered us, but still they continued to force us," unquote. I was cracking up. I was they were milk. Is that all you have? And then they just get fucking obliterated in the daytime. They're just having a blast. They ended up staying there for about 4 weeks until all the coronation festivities were over. And after Kuyuk was made emperor, they were finally summoned before him. He continues, quote, "And when the Tartars had searched us carefully for knives and found none, we entered the doorway on the eastern side because no one except the emperor alone dares enter by the western side." I don't know what that means. There were so many gifts given in rich cloth and silken belts worked with gold, rich furs, and other gifts that it was wonderful to see. Of course, we were asked whether we wished to give gifts, but we had used up almost all we had so that we had little to give. I was worried there would be a horrific consequence for that, but there wasn't. I think they were kind of just heavily judged.
This is my empty Ninja Turtle lunch pail.
And they're love it.
This is all I have to my name.
They're okay, this is embarrassing. You can keep that. No, you need it more than I do. So he goes on to describe the tents of the emperor and his wives, which were made of white felt and were very large and beautiful. And then he talks about, when they're having their audience with the emperor or the great Khan, a lot of other people are there too for audiences. And the way that the tent is set up, they get to watch him pass judgment on the other people in line before them. So that was kind of cool. He describes the benches and how they were kind of a stadium almost. So Kuyuk Khan judges his aunt's case. She had apparently poisoned his father. Did you talk about this?
His aunt.
Or is this different?
His father is Ogade? Oh,
yeah.
No, I guess
I can't remember.
I didn't mention anything about him being poisoned.
They just have a lot going on then.
Who the fuck's his aunt?
I can't remember her name. I don't think it was in the story.
It would be, what, his dad's sister?
I think so. Yeah, I'm not sure.
I know that there were like two or three other siblings alongside the brothers, but I have no idea who they are, obviously, because women don't matter.
Right. And yeah, and this is really skimmed over.
Yeah, it's other like, than oh, when yeah. they're doing something bad and we're accusing them of something.
Right. Like, oh yeah, she poisoned his dad, so he had her killed. And like the end, moving on. Next audience. he also meets lots of people while he's in the tent, like watching all this and staying there for a month. So he meets Ruthenians, who are apparently from the area that's now Ukraine. There are Hungarians there. There are Russians. There are Chinese people there. So there are people who speak his language and who have been in the court of the Khan for many years. So they can like translate for him and tell him like what's going on and like more like customs and etiquette about the land. I believe that this is what he's basing a lot of the information in his book on, is what he learned in this just camp.
Chatting in the tent.
Yep. Killing time, drinking ale.
So what's up with these guys?
So what's up with all this milk?
Other than the mare's milk and the getting us drunk and taking all our shit under the guise of hospitality. Surely there's more.
Right. Yeah, so this is when he learns about like their marriage customs and their laws and the like, oh, don't go on that part of the tent, or like don't pee in the river and stuff like that. Finally, excuse me, finally they get to have their audience and they give him the Pope's letter. Just like so wrinkled by now.
Unpin it from his chest.
Exactly. Take it out of the sandwich bag. Kuyu Khan writes a letter in return, and it is painstakingly translated with the help of several different interpreters again. The letter basically says, I'm actually not interested in becoming a Christian. Thank you very much. We will have peace, because the Pope is like, oh, let us have peace. And the Khan says, we will have peace if you bow down to me and acknowledge me as your supreme ruler and say that I am the ruler of all the land.
That was their stipulation for most people, you know, bow down to the great Khan. And most people are like, we're not going to fucking do that. And so they're like, well, we're going to handle this the only way we know how. Murder.
Cut your fucking wieners off. Yeah. Yeah, which they didn't, shockingly. You know, they didn't really invade, at least not like on a huge scale of Europe.
They started to fall apart very quickly. They were fighting each other.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, true, as we saw. So Carpini spent several months in Karakorum, but didn't really get to see the emperor much at all. He only has like one direct description of Kuyu Khan, which is, quote, this emperor, who must be 40 or 45 years old or more, is of medium height, very wise and extremely clever, and very serious and strict in his morals, so that no one ever easily sees him laugh or make a joke. That's really all we get.
That's definitely what I pictured. But it's very funny to think of a 45-year-old man, like his campaign being run by his mommy, as opposed to like the 20-year-old that I was picturing.
Yeah, it does seem like he should be younger based on your story. This story makes him seem the right age.
Could you, like, I'm picturing my dad, who's in, like, his 50s, not too far off. Like, imagining my grandma going around being like, you could not imagine how good of a job that this fine young man would do.
Your grandma showing up at your dad's IT job.
Yes. Shaking hands, doing backroom deals.
Yes, that's good. I'm seeing it all in my head. The con did not dismiss Carpini and Benedict until November. When it was finally time for them to leave, it was suggested that they take Tartar, or Mongol, he calls them Tartars, and I got stuck in that, that they take Mongol ambassadors back with them to the Pope. They're like, hey, you came over, how about we come over now? And Carpini's like, not a good idea. He is worried that if the Mongols were to see how... He has lots of worries. He thinks, oh my god, like, I can't bring them back. They're going to see how, like, divided Europe is. Mm-hmm. Like, they're talking about Europe as if it's this, like, one singular nation with, like... And the Pope is the leader of it. If they see that it's like, you know, you walk 10 feet and you're in a different country with a different king, they're going to be like, this is going to be so easy.
So easy.
Yeah. Which it would have been. He is also worried that the ambassadors could be murdered by Europeans. He says that he's seen on his journey there, he saw Germans stone foreigners. Like, just fucking whack them, like farmers, not even, you know, like soldiers or anything, just like a farmer, like, picked up a stone and, like, chucked it at a random guy's head. He's like, I can't bring them back. They're going to be killed. And then what happens? Yeah. And then they'll find out, and then they will invade Europe because of that lack of hospitality, and it'll all be my fault. It's just not a good idea. So he is thankfully able to talk his way out of that. He's like, no, actually, we're good. Like, we made it here.
How about we just become pen pals?
Yes, exactly. So soon after receiving gifts of foxskin cloaks from the emperor's mother, the mom made them care packages to take with them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And soon after that, they are making the long journey back to Europe. He writes, quote, we took up the way back and traveled through the entire winter, often sleeping in wastelands in the snow, where we could make a place in the snow with our feet, because there were no trees, but only a flat plain, and we often found ourselves completely covered with snow when the wind blew. He writes that they arrived in Kyiv 15 days after the feast of John the Baptist, which would be July 9th. So at this point, they've been gone for about 15 months. They were welcomed at Kyiv as though they had risen from the dead.
Holy shit! It's so great. We didn't think you were going to be back. I mean, it's great to see you. I mean,
holy.
How was the trip?
No one expected it. Like, oh, how did the pictures God.
Turn out?
I turned your room into a gym. My bad. Yeah, the pictures. And he's just like staring deadpan like this, like so mad. I drank so much fucking mare's milk. It's disgusting.
And then consequently so much alcohol. I was so fucking wasted.
I actually was wondering, like, I know, like, probably ale was, like, a lot weaker back then, but, like, if you're being forced to chug even, like, you know, a 3% beer, like, that'll catch up with you, and, like,
how much are, like, travel sick on top of it?
Mm-hmm.
I've been so fucked up. There's wobbling all over the place.
They've had no water. They're like eating handfuls of snow every now and then.
I cannot imagine the jokes that the Mongols must have been making about like their weak constitutions.
Yeah.
They can't even ride a horse and drink ale.
Just wobbling around, toppling over. And I wonder how much of like his time in the capital that he was like blacked out for. Anyway, that's where Carpini ends his journal, but he obviously continued on and delivered the letter to the Pope. As the first European to have visited Mongolia and returned to talk about it, he became a bit of a celebrity. He actually went on a lecture tour across the continent, where he talked about what he had seen, and obviously he wrote his book. He was also rewarded with the Archbishopric of Antivari, I think. I didn't look that up. In Dalmatia, or modern-day Croatia, making him the primate of Serbia. But according to the Franciscan Martyrology, he died only 5 years after returning from his journey on August 1st, 1252. I guess all the beer and milk really got to him at last. And that is the story of Giovanni or John de Plano Carpini, the weenie.
Carpini the weenie. I like that. I like the fact that it connected right to like the end of my stuff.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah, I got to see a bit of it, like all of the different people who were in the tent, all of the languages that would have been floating around.
Yeah, that part was really cool to me.
Yeah, because anything I read didn't really get into like a really close picture really of what like the Mongolian Empire looked like. It was so like, and this is where they conquered, and this is where they went, and this is who died, and this real is who was broad. Poisoned.
Yeah.
Like you get to learn pretty much like the anthropological stuff that Carpini wrote about the Mongols, and then everything is just abroad. Like, here's the military shit that happened.
Right. Yeah. I also thought it was cool. I felt like your story made everyone seem like really larger than life, which was like really cool. But then the small moments of like, oh, I know her from your story. She's the mother of the Khan, and she made them foxskin cloaks to take back with them.
And then I like the grounded of yours, because for me, it's like, oh, it's just this name and this story who, you know, was accused of like witchcraft, died, you know, all of that. And it's like, oh, but in your story, like, I'm sitting amongst everybody looking out across all of this, and it's that person to the left of so-and-so.
Right. Yeah, that was good. I felt like we got a nice picture together.
We did. A nice, very rounded picture of the Mongolian Empire, a lot of the people that were there, the wonky crap that they were up to. They're just... Getting men drunk.
Taking their pelts.
And then sending them home with the same pelts because they're too drunk to notice.
As gifts, re-gifting the pelts because they didn't want them.
It's like a fruitcake.
They're like, oh, you have it. You keep it.
Well, you've earned it. Let me just look amongst all of these pelts. This happens to be the best one I own.
They're like, would you believe
the one you brought me?
You're like, oh my god, I love it. It's so beautiful.
Pass that outside in a bank of snow.
Just vomit everywhere.
Yeah. The terrible, terrible weather. Lightning and hail everywhere. The winds. Mm-hmm.
Right, actually accidentally puke in the river and just get your head cut off. That was good. That was really fun.
That was fun. I liked that.
I did too. That was a good choice.
I can't wait to see where we are next for episode 71.
Mm-hmm.
How many are we going to get to this year? Well, at least
75. That'll be the last one of the year, right?
I can't count.
70 is July. 71 is August. 72 is September. 73 is October. Yeah. 75 will be December's episode.
75 by the end of this year.
Let's plan something special, but not difficult, because I don't have the energy.
75 will be yours because it's odd.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it'll be around Christmas. So,
yeah, that's true. A Christmas spectacular. I don't know what that means.
I promise to do all of my research the day before.
Like, always. Me too. And that is a guarantee.
there's anything that's a constant on this show, it's
the sheer panic and terror.
We do everything last minute, but by God, did we get it done.
Mm-hmm. Every time, baby.
Anyway,
thank you so much for listening. We love you. But we're not in love with you.
It's not you. It's me.
It's us.
We've already discussed we have commitment problems. We had to handcuff ourselves together.
So. As we drove off the cliff, that is this podcast.
Yeah,
Thelma and Louise style. Yeah, yep. That's us. We will see you next time. You know how to get in touch with us. DM us on Instagram is probably the quickest way if you have a suggestion. And yeah, thanks be to God.